Cindy, I had a nervous breakdown, and I got a rash all over my body, kind of a purple rash. I was really very sick. And what I used to do is cry. I cried all the time. Every night I cried. Anyway, a little later I began to feel better, and being that I just told me not to go back to school that year, I went to work. I became secretary of the local, Deathmakers local, at that time, and became very active in the union.
This is in Chicago.
In Chicago. 1919 broke out a clockmaker strike. I worked on skirts in a clockmaker shop. I got at that time $67.50 a week. And I was elected to be a delegate to the Chicago Federation of Labor. John Fitzpatrick was at that time at the head of the Chicago Federation of Labor. And the talk was at that time, the fight for an 8-hour day began. I was elected among five women, the manager of the Women's State Union League and four other girls, and I was one of them, to go to Springfield, Illinois to appear before a joint meeting of the Senate and the House of the State of Illinois to talk about an 8-hour day. They asked us questions, the girls. And we answered. Well, if you want something funny, I will tell you. First of all, one senator, big fat man, the big stomach, I'll never forget him, he graduated law school the same year as my brother. And my brother at that time was a lawyer already. He was an attorney. But he went to school at night. He worked in the daytime and at night. And this fellow knew my brother because they graduated together. I didn't know him. But he said, Vexel said, that when I spoke, I looked like my brother. I really don't, but that's what he felt. The way I spoke, that he reminded him of Sam Holland. Anyway, he said that we girls came from Chicago. There is an envelope factory in the southern of Illinois. They're working 10 hours a day, and they took a service of the girls, and nobody said that they would rather work 8 hours a day. They're always willing to work 10 hours a day. What would you say to that? I said, well, two things. Either they were scared to death of losing their job, or they should go to a sanitarium for a psychiatrist. Everybody left. It was such a laughter, you know, everybody left. Anyway, we were there 2 days, because the meeting again was the next morning. The providers for us left to sleep in a hotel. And you know that that year, the 8-hour law passed, because there was in the Senate, and the House had the 8-hour law. And that's year, the 8-hour law passed. That was in 1920.
That
was about 1919. Yes. Kind of riots. But in 1920, I think, the
8-hour
law passed.
Were you affected by the
policy? No.
Anybody knew?
No. It was not in our line at all. I knew about it, sure. But I had nothing to do with it.
How was the reaction to that?
It was terrible. The whole city was agog. It was a terrible strike because people were killed, shot, and scabs. There were many scabs. The Palmer strike is a historical highlight as far as Chicago is concerned. But I was not a part of it. Now, in 1920,
I became the chair lady of Walk 100, which was the dressmaker's welcome. And we had a very good organization, over 4,000 girls. And we, of course, worked for higher wages and better conditions, and better unions usually working for. And the 8-hour day was not only ours, it was all the unions, including the Chicago Federation of Labor and all the others, who were fighting for the 8-hour day, you see. That was a general thing. Now, as I said, I was very active. I was selling a Walk 100, member of the joint board, which we had, you know, clockmakers and the pressers and the finishers. That was in 1921.
And that's when you were
at the end of 1921, I left, went to New York.
Brooklyn?
No.
No?
I went to New York at the end of 1921 and for arrest. But a strike broke out in the dressmaker's union. So I took a job in the children's dressmaker shop. So they also went on strike. So they got me into the strike, and I became a, they gave me a hall in Brownsville. So I was, you know, I mean, to take that to be the charity of the hall, which you call, you know, to see that the strikers, you know, go on picket lines and then they come back and to accept them and all that stuff. That is during the strike.
Strike
headquarters? Strike headquarters. It wasn't Brownsville, I don't yet remember the address. After the strike was over, we won it. A lot of little things in it, but it's not important, I don't think. I stayed with the Local 91 till it was 92, till at the end of 92. Then I went to Brooklyn.
When did you get married?
I got married 1927.
And did you keep your maiden name? I mean, was there any reason why you kept
the
union to do
it
because you were
now? Well, it was already on that way, so in the union. So there's, you know, the only time I worked when I was married was really here in New York, in Chicago, in Los Angeles.
So marriage really changed a lot about your life.
Well, it changed a lot. 1925, President Zygmunt sent me back to Chicago. Because they had a strike there, which they lost. And he said that I was the only one that can do it because I knew the girls and I knew the, you know, the setup in Chicago. So I came back to Chicago in 1925, in September. And I began going, visiting the homes of the girls who used to be active in Walk 100. And finally, after about 5 or 6 months, we had a charter again and a union again. And I stayed in the, at that time, at the head of Local 25, and then I got 30, of course, manager, whatever you want to call it. And I decided I've had enough of it. I wanted to just take a rest. So I and two other girls, we decided we'd go rest. And that time we went by train, of course. So we went to Colorado and we spent a lot of time there and there and everything. Finally we came to Chicago, to Los Angeles, and we went to Catalina Island for a couple of weeks, took a rest there. And then the three of us took a cottage. We rented a cottage. And we went to work. That was in 1925. That's where I met my husband in 1925, because he also had come to Los Angeles from New York. And we had a large group here who used to hitchhike. And we hitchhiked to almost all the mountains around here. Till 1925.
Till 1925?
In 1925, at the end of 1925,
three of the boys who used to hitchhike together with all of us bought cars, and then we traveled by car. Chevy. They all thought there was open Chevy. 1926. We traveled a lot. 1926, we made the trip all north up to Canada, all the mountains. And he climbed mountains at the very top, and we girls climbed the pathway. And we had a good time here until, we got married in 1927. And we went for another trip with another couple, and we landed in Chicago. When my husband got a work, which he didn't like, in the shop, I didn't like Chicago either. So after we were there a few months, we decided to go back to Los Angeles and came back. And we went to work. We both worked. But I still stayed on my maiden name because my card was my maiden name. Everything was a maiden name, and I didn't see any reason for change. So that's how it stayed on.
It's kind of like
you
have a lot of mobility, though. I mean, it's really interesting because women are keeping their maiden
name. I kept a lot of mobility. But you see, I always tell you the difference between the present liberation in women and us women in our time is entirely different. Because we fought for something.
That's what I wanted to know. How did you manage to be,
our girls were not the type of girls that you see now. We weren't interested in sex. We weren't interested in disease. We weren't interested in all these things that bothered us. We were at that time interested in the equality of respect, work, wages, an organization.
We're without.
With the union or without the union?
So, did it have anything to do with the suffrage women?
Suffrage women? No.
No.
No. Our type of women were not suffrage women.
How did you relate to suffrage women?
Most of the suffrage women that I knew were fancy ladies.
Mm-hmm.
We were workers.
So they really didn't relate at all to them.
And we didn't teach. So, you see, there was no, now for instance, there was a woman, Mrs. McCormick. She was a millionaire. She came from millionaires. And what do I got to do with her? She didn't understand me.
Right.
I maybe could understand her, but she couldn't understand me.
But how did you get to the point? I mean, you were brought up pretty traditionally, right?
Yeah, religiously.
So how did you manage to get to the point where you... I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Well, what you're trying to say is this. I went to work. I was a rebel. By nature, I was a rebel. And when I sat in the shop with a Polish girl on one side and a Italian girl on the other side, and another was Jewish girl on this side and another girl on that side, all the people were important to me. You see? A lot of these girls were foreigners because this was a period, don't forget, it was a period when many foreigners came to the United States. And many of these girls were foreigners. They couldn't even speak English. Now, I remember when I used to make our cards for getting money, you know, for numbers of the addresses that we made, for instance. I used to make it out for a couple of girls because they didn't know how to write. And the fair lady, we didn't trust. So, for instance, when Mary asked me to make out a card for her with her numbers, I'd make it out for her to give it into the office so she gets paid for her addresses at the end of the week that she made, you see. But we were together that way because the rich people who fought for suffrage weren't the people like us. They didn't respect us, and we didn't respect them either.
Because to us, you know, they used to invite a lot of girls, you know, Mrs. McCormick used to make sometimes on a Sunday, and invite a lot of girls. And I once spoke about it, and I said, to me, it's the same thing, like if they just have dogs. They take care of dogs.
So they, yeah.
You see?
They didn't take any
care of dogs. Because mentally, they didn't respect us, you see? And to me, it was taking care of us was the same thing as taking care of dogs. And I remember when I joined this Women's Trade Union League, I was very active in Chicago, and when we came to New York, I was very active there, at the end of 1921-22, and I was in New York 22-23. Of course, then at the end of 23, I went to Brookwood, and I was there 24-25, I went back to Chicago. The only woman that I thought of, the rich women, that were really people that you could talk to, was Mrs. Roosevelt. Because she didn't dress well, and she didn't talk well. And she used to come every month to the Women's Trade Union League and sit with everybody else and discuss things with everybody else.
And join the picket line.
And she used to be on the picket line. And she used to help us. So that was a different type of that, you know. Most of the rich women at that time, what they wanted was not important to us, you know, because it's not what we wanted. We wanted equality in our livelihood and in our respect, and be in equal terms with the men in the shop.
Right.
You see, I wouldn't want that the men should get 90 cents for a steak, and I should get only 60. This was the important thing for us, and that's how we fought. And we were very active in the Chicago Federation of Labor.
Did the men work with you as far as equal wages?
Yes.
There wasn't a lot of resistance.
No. And we never had trouble with our men. In fact, when we had strikes in shops, most of them were women, and the men helped us. Our men were with us all the way through.
That's enough for today.